Thanks for listening. Start your day tomorrow with Up First, the morning news podcast from NPR. Apple Podcast reviewer Coley B says, "I hop in the train and get up to date in 12 minutes or so." However you get to work, Up First makes the ride better. Listen tomorrow morning on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, Stephen Thompson.
Hi, Linda Holmes.
Hello! My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die!
Stephen, do you recognize that clip, which is arguably one of the most quoted lines in film history?
Yeah, I am pretty sure you're talking about The Princess Bride, the 1987 film adaptation of William Goldman's novel.
I am. And if you look at your calendar, you'll see that it's the film's 30th anniversary. So today we are talking about one of the most loved films of the 1980s.
Inconceivable!
Don't go away.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from Boomerang, a new subscription video app offering timeless cartoons and new original animated series. Take a deep dive into cartoon pop culture with Bugs, Daffy, and all of the Looney Tunes, Scooby-Doo and the Gang, the Smurfs, and more of your favorites. To laugh along with all of these iconic characters, you can find Boomerang on the web, mobile, Apple TV, Amazon Fire, Roku, and Chromecast. Visit boomerang.com/promo and use the promo code HAPPY to start your free trial.
Before we get started, let's introduce our other panelists. You know Glenn Weldon, who writes for NPR.org. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair from New York and from Code Switch is Kat Chow. Hi, Kat.
Hey, Linda.
So The Princess Bride.
Uh-huh.
You know, this is, Stephen and I spoke once about how this is part of a really tremendous run that Rob Reiner had as a director with Spinal Tap and this and Stand By Me. And there's just a whole run of really good stuff that he did in the 80s that's very nostalgically important to people.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the most quoted movies in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, one of the best reasons to watch it again is to remember that it's better than listening to people quote it.
Yep.
Do you think I am correct, Glenn Weldon?
Yeah. I mean, I never read the William Goldman book. It was published in 1973. And I never saw this in a theater. This came out while I was in college. And I was first exposed to it in a dorm room on a VHS tape. And I watched it a couple times since then. Since then, it has existed only in the ether as something you would flick by on television. So you only catch it in snippets.
Mm-hmm.
So watching it again all the way through for this was just a joy because this thing is just charming as hell. It's weaponized charm.
Yeah. If you're not familiar with the story in The Princess Bride, such as it is, it is about a young woman who is chosen as the bride of an evil prince, Humperdinck. And she takes her away from her true love, a young man named Wesley, who she had fallen in love with when he was just the simple
farm boy.
Just a farm boy working on her family's farm. And then there's a lot of, I don't even know how to describe what happens after that. There's a lot of adventure
There's a quest.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's a quest. There's all this other stuff that goes on. There's sword fighting. There's Mandy Patinkin. There's, you know, Wallace Shawn. And there is also a framing device, we should mention, that has Peter Falk as a grandpa in modern day telling this as a bedtime story to itty-bitty Fred Savage.
Yep.
Kat, you know, Glenn mentioned that he did not see this because it came out when he was in college. I think this came out when you were not existent yet.
Yes. I haven't seen it since I was very, very young, from the time when my sisters first introduced it to me. But like, although I didn't remember the plot points as I was rewatching it, I still was, like, bracing for the key lines when Inigo Montoya says, like, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." Because my family would quote that all the time.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, as I was, like, waiting for all these quotes that I've grown up hearing over and over again, I kept bracing myself for this feeling of, oh, God, how is this movie going to age? You know, now that I'm an adult watching it, is this Princess Buttercup character really gonna bother me? Just because of how she's portrayed as a woman, kind of like a damsel in distress.
She sure is, yeah.
For sure. And, I mean, it's still a really enjoyable movie for me, but that was something that I kept thinking, ugh.
Yeah.
If only they could modernize it.
No, well, there's some truth to that. It's definitely, like, it's a fairy tale, genuinely, even though it was written in 73, as Glenn mentioned. But it's a fairy tale in style.
Sure.
Right? It's all prince and princess and magic and where are you on this movie, Thompson?
Well, it's interesting. When you talk about the quotability of this movie and how this is one of the most quotable movies of all time, I think that's a product of the fact that it is almost universally loved. Mm-hmm. And it is maybe one of the most universally beloved movies there are.
Send your contrary emails.
Send your contrary emails to somebody other than me, because I love this movie. But one of the interesting things that that produces, it is the monoculture. It has become the monoculture, and like your hipster friend probably likes it, and your uncle who sends you chain emails probably likes it.
Yeah.
And all of those people can suddenly speak in one common language around this movie, which I think is a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Certain quotes from this movie have become a little bit wearying when you hear them quoted as if merely quoting them were a joke. At the same time, I think other than a few kind of more fairy tale elements, one of the things that makes this movie work so well is how relatively timeless it is.
Yeah.
There are very few timestamps in this movie. A little bit
Of the 80s.
There are a little bit of hair feathering. The Chicago Bears are relevant to someone. that's how you know it's the 80s.
Uh-huh.
But for the most part, it really does kind of exist separately from the culture of the time in ways that make it really enduring.
Mm-hmm. And it's a testament to old-style movie making, which sounds weird to say about a film that came out when it came out, but there are great locations, and that's one of the things you notice watching it again as an adult is just how gorgeously it looks. There's also an extended sword fight on what is clearly a soundstage.
Yeah.
In a way you don't see anymore with a fake sunset that just hangs there. They're actually sword fighting. It's actually those two actors actually going through the motions, doing it, really knocking themselves out, looking great. It just feels like you're watching, like, I don't know, Captain Blood or some kind of old-fashioned film. It's borrowing on that. It's drafting off of that.
Yeah. And one of the things that I was thinking about earlier today is that it didn't really make movie stars out of anybody, right? Mm-hmm. Robin Wright still works, right?
Sure.
And probably works now more than she did for a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
And after this. I mean, I think House of Cards, and she was just in Wonder Woman. We just saw her in Blade Runner 2049. You still see Cary Elwes. But he didn't do that again.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? When my family moved out of the house that we had lived in for a long time when I was a kid, the person who came into it changed it all around.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, that's very upsetting. But on the other hand, it's kind of like, well, that makes sense. That was the only way it was going to be that way. Once we were gone, it had to be a totally different thing for somebody else. And there's part of me that's like, Cary Elwes went on and did a bunch of other stuff, but he never really did in any kind of high profile project this kind of dashing
Errol Flynn.
You know, and he's very good at it.
He's very good
and
at it.
And he's so beautiful at this stage of his life. I think they caught him. You know how you take photos during the golden hour?
Mm-hmm.
I think this was, and I mean this as pure compliment, I think they found the exact Cary Elwes golden hour.
Yeah.
Because he's
those
so
eyes.
Those
perfect.
Eyes, man. He smolders in this film from the very first shot. And I figured it out.
Oh, yeah.
He never blinks.
Right.
Oh, never boy. Once in this entire film. That puts him on a different plane than the other actors.
Well, because he was a robot.
Well, he's a replicant, clearly. But I mean, he is just giving you so much. And it's a much more naturalistic performance coming from Robin Wright, right? She is not this sort of untouchable goddess.
Yeah.
He is an untouchable god.
Yeah.
One thing I really like about this movie on rewatching it, and I've actually watched it several times in recent years because I got to show it to kids for the first time, which is very, very, very fun, by the way. One of the things I like about it is that these characters are all compromised in some way. As much as this is a fairy tale, it's not necessarily a pure good versus evil.
No.
Yes, there's true love is this very black and white thing. If you break it down character by character, you know, Fezzik was going to bash the guy's head in. Inigo Montoya is a hired killer.
Played by Andre the Giant and Mandy Patinkin.
Respectively. But Wesley goes off and becomes a murderous pirate. Princess Buttercup is imperious and not necessarily super likable for a big chunk of this movie. And I think that gives it a little bit more depth and a little bit more relatability than if it were a pure fairy tale.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I just think that Cary Elwes' character especially exemplifies that, as you were mentioning. Like, he plays this pirate that killed people, but also he is this incredibly charming, intelligent character that I feel like, I mean, to your point before, Linda, it's kind of shocking to me that, you know, he wasn't asked to kind of reprise that role over and over and over and over again as the romantic lead in so many other movies.
Right.
What he did do, though, was write a book called As You Wish, which is about the filming of this. And I have not read it, but I have just had people telling me how great the audiobook is.
Yeah.
Because he gets Wally Shawn to come on and read the audio, the Wally Shawn parts.
Oh, boy.
Speaking of Wally Shawn, can we just take a moment here? Now, Wally Shawn is the son of William Shawn, the editor of The New Yorker for many years, and the journalist Cecile Lyon. And so he grew up in the heart of the crotch of the Manhattan literary scene.
I mean, he's my dinner with Andre.
He's my dinner with Andre. He's an accomplished playwright, a great stage actor, and to this day, for 30 years, every time this poor guy's in an airport, somebody comes up to him and goes, "Bro, inconceivable."
He didn't
sign on for that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there's a difference between the things that you do that are great and the things that you do that are loved, right? Yeah. And I think this, for many people, is both. I'm not running down the Princess Bride, right? But I do think what elevates this movie to the level that it's reached, where people talk about it on its 30th anniversary, is that really personal connection that people feel like they have to it, which has a lot to do with rewatchability, has a lot to do with the ability to watch with lots of different kinds of people.
Yep.
And one of the things I love about the comedy is that although its reputation is quite reasonably for quotable lines, one of the things that it has is funny ideas.
Yeah.
The whole idea of the battle of wits that happens between Vizzini and Wesley is a funny idea, and where it goes is a funny idea. Yeah. The whole thing of the way that Wesley ultimately kind of taunts Humperdinck when they collide with each other is a funny idea.
Yep.
And also the sword fighting scene that Glenn talked about turns on a funny idea. So it does have quotable lines, but there are comic notions in the film other than just the one-liner. I think it's the combination of both. And it winds up being a collection of set pieces that are really satisfying. The set piece, as you know, the couple ones that I've mentioned, and also the bit with Carol Kane and Billy Crystal trying to revive a dead body.
I loved that.
There's only so much Billy Crystal in that mode that I need in a movie, and it's this much.
Yeah, it's exactly this much. And I remember reading somewhere that he ad-libbed, you know,
like a lot of that.
A lot of that. And people have said, like, "Oh, man, that stuff is lost to the ages." And I'm like, no, I have exactly as much of that as I want and need. I will say that the joy of watching this with somebody for the first time, watching it with a kid for the first time, I had this wonderful experience watching it with my daughter, who was probably at the time 8 or 9 and already a cynic. And early in the movie, where Princess Buttercup and Wesley kiss and the music swells, and she goes, "Ugh, God," 3 seconds before Fred Savage does.
Yeah.
And you realize, like, this movie is so finely calibrated that it can be the same experience to an 8-year-old now that it was to an 8-year-old then.
Yeah.
Going off of that thought, Stephen, what I've been wondering as we've been talking, and what I'm sure maybe some people listening are wondering also, is, was this movie, when it first came out, an immediate success, or did it kind of take time for people to really catch on and get it?
It's an interesting question, because it's always hard to remember what you thought about a movie when you were like 16 or 17. Because I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to industry. I don't remember it being perceived as not successful.
Right.
But I don't think anybody can predict which of a lot of kind of liked movies are going to have the kind of tail that this one did.
Right.
And I think this movie kind of came along at the right time for kind of the early boom in renting movies and, you know, on a Friday night and that kind of thing.
And this was an era when Hollywood was pumping out a lot of fantasy, high fantasy in a way that it didn't usually do. So Out Labyrinth was the year before. Willow, is the year after. And Labyrinth certainly has gone on to have a life, but not it's not this. It's not this phenomenon. It doesn't have this universality. Reiner describes it as a satire and a fairy tale, both.
Right.
And it's really leaning much harder into the fairy tale than the satire. Right. There's elements of it. There's attitudinal adjustments, basically. But it's really, it's earnest in a way.
Yeah. The satirical notes are a little bit more evident in the book, which I did read. Stephen mentioned that framing device. And I think that framing device is so important because it allows you a lot of leeway with an audience once you acknowledge that what you are telling is just a story to tell a kid,
yeah.
you know, or just a story yeah. that a kid will find fun and interesting. And there's a great moment when Buttercup seems to be in great peril. And Peter Falk, as the grandfather, has to kind of check in
yep.
with Fred Savage about his reaction to this scary moment. It's such a small and warm exchange between the two of them. I like it so much. And boy, you know, producer Jessica, when we were talking about this movie yesterday and watching some clips, was like pointing out Fred Savage was always a really, really good kid actor.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah
you know,
so adorable.
Yeah.
He's the reason that that framing device does not devolve into saccharine cuteness
yeah.
or sentiment.
Yeah.
And it's such a smart thing to kind of keep that. I hesitate to call it an edge, but it's an edge.
To, yeah. to have somebody undercut the saccharine a little bit. I also want to speak to one thing that a movie like this can very often get wrong. I think this movie has great villains.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that the villains are necessarily talked about as much. I mean, yes, they talk about mm-hmm. Vizzini, but I think particularly Christopher Guest as the six-fingered man. Christopher Guest, you know, you see him, he's so funny in these other films, in his own movies. Here, you don't usually see him play a villain.
Mm-hmm.
And his kind of creepy, understated calm
right.
is such a clever touch, especially set against Prince Humperdinck.
Right.
In his own way, he's a genuinely scary villain.
Yeah, well, and Humperdinck is a very different kind of, just a sort of breezy, oh, well, all right. You know, just a kind of a, it's a very interesting take on villainy. And as Stephen said, you have kind of a more mustache twirly cartoon villain on the Christopher Guest side, on the six-fingered man side. And then you have more of an imperious sort of, as Stephen mentioned, Princess Buttercup can be imperious, but, you know, Humperdinck kind of takes that to a very, very high
right.
level. And I really appreciate just the fact that they said, what should he be named? Humperdinck.
Right?
Mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm. That seems good. Every time I watch it, I am impressed by how many people this movie caught at a great moment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So we talked about Cary Elwes, but also this moment with Christopher Guest, with Chris Sarandon, with Billy Crystal and mm-hmm. Carol Kane, this Mandy Patinkin thing, which really isn't a part of Mandy Patinkin that almost anybody else has ever used
yeah.
this much.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And Andre the Giant, who is so funny, even though kind of not an actor.
Mm. Well, not at all an actor.
Is funny in it in this way where he feels in on the joke,
yeah.
even though the jokes could appear to be at his expense, mm-hmm. you know? I feel like.
I really love Andre the Giant.
In this yeah.
movie.
yeah.
Yeah. He's one of my favorite characters.
Mine too. And apparently, like, if you read, you know, the backstory of this movie, like, he apparently, when he read for the part, like, nobody could understand a single word that he said. And he basically had to, like, learn his lines phonetically
yeah.
To make them legible as they are,
yeah.
which is not
yeah.
that much.
In fairness, yeah. he went from, like, a zero to, like, a 7,
but
maybe?
I love him so much.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
Well, and he does it the right way in that even when you can't necessarily, I mean, I think it took me a couple runs through this movie to be able to make out all of
sure.
his lines, but you get the feel that he's sort of the, there's a really funny moment when he conks a guy on the head.
Yep.
There's a, his friendship with Inigo is the important thing about his character in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that always comes out, that they have this relationship where they're very close buddies and I don't know. Kat, I want to ask you, what is the status of this movie among people your age? Like, because we all love
oh,
it. We all have this, like, sort of nostalgic attachment to it, or at least nostalgic attachment to the idea of it. What is the status of it among your friends?
I've been wondering about that as you guys have been talking, because I've been like I doubt my friends or people my age. Not that I'm going to speak for everyone who's, you know,
of course
in my
not,
age group.
Of course not. You could. Neither could we.
I do wonder if that many people have rewatched it. I mean, certainly I have a lot of friends who still quote it, like, you know, as you wish.
Right.
And it gets to the point of, I think, as Glenn was saying, it's almost a little bit cheesy.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, people don't really fan out about it in my circles. But it is one, I mean, like, with all of this anniversary coverage coming, I wonder if there's going to be if I'm going to see more nostalgia from people my age.
Well, it is cultural furniture, right? It's just part of the background noise. There was a 20th edition DVD. There was a 25th anniversary edition DVD. There will certainly be a 30th anniversary.
Yeah.
So when you watch it on iTunes, if you download it, you have all, like you keep seeing people age five-year chunks because they keep going back to them and re-interviewing them and keeps telling the same stories.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like a classic. It's like the classics.
Yeah, I do want to put in a plug for the book in that if you like the movie and you like the parts of it where it's outside of itself a little bit, mm-hmm. where, you know, the sort of the heroes and villains are commenting on heroes and villains, that sort of action in the film, check out the book. It is by William Goldman, who also wrote the screenplay for the film. It's credited to someone named S. Morgenstern, who does not exist because it's sort of a fictional whatever. At any rate, I do recommend the book also. All right. Well, you know, we want to hear what you think of The Princess Bride, whether you have seen it long ago or just recently. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH.
Finally, one last note we wanted to tack on at the end. We recorded this episode last Friday before we got word of the death of Tom Petty. Petty died Monday. He was a huge MTV star in the 80s and early 90s with videos like Don't Come Around Here No More and Free Fallin'. Because he'd cultivated an image as kind of a plain everyman, and because he resided in a gray area between pop and rock and folk, Tom Petty doesn't always get the credit he deserves as a towering figure in rock and roll. From the late 70s on, Tom Petty was a lot of things. He was a hit maker with your classic rock staples like Refugee and The Waiting. He was an influencer on so many major folk rock singers over the years. He was also a member of the Traveling Wilburys with guys like Bob Dylan and Roy Orbison. But at the same time, he was also a stellar songwriter to the end, with this tender side that came out in these sweeter songs like Wildflowers. So as someone who wore out his cassette copy of 1989's Full Moon Fever back in the late 80s and early 90s, I'm so sad to hear of his death. So we didn't want his passing to go unmentioned here. Thanks so much for listening, and we will see you on Friday.